Hi, it's Diane. Great to be with you. On my mind, impeachment. Calls to remove President Trump have been heard since the day he took office. After Trump fired former FBI Director James Comey, talk of impeachment became louder. But with a Republican-controlled Congress, that was all it was, talk. Now that Democrats have a majority in the House, that could change. But should the House move to impeach? The Atlantic's Yoni Applebaum says yes. He looks to history to make his argument in the March issue of The Atlantic. Yoni, it's good to have you here.
Oh, it's nice to be back.
You've been calling for impeachment of President Trump. How come?
Well, I have come to think of impeachment as a remedy devised for the political crisis the nation presently faces. So I had originally thought of it as an outcome and have swung around to think of it as a process, as a means of resolving a debate over the fitness of a president to serve, and really the only constitutional means of having and resolving that debate. And since we're having that debate, it seems like we ought to trigger the mechanism to do it properly.
You're a trained historian, and I gather initially you were looking at the impeachment of Andrew Johnson.
Yes, that's right. I thought I would write a wonderful history of an earlier episode with contemporary echoes, and found myself surprised as I delved into the sources and read Johnson's speeches and the transcripts of testimony of the inquiries and then the actual trial, that the story that I had learned was not the story that I was encountering. Johnson's impeachment is often presented as a baldly political act and a dangerous episode in our past when we came close to removing a chief executive for purely political reasons, a cautionary tale, if you will. And instead, what I saw was a process functioning largely as it should, and one that averted quite a few much worse outcomes that loomed in the offing.
Can you briefly give me the circumstances that led up to that call for impeachment?
Yeah, Andrew Johnson comes to office, and nobody expects him to be president. He's considered uncultured. He comes from the East Tennessee Hill Country. He's the wartime Democratic governor of Tennessee. And so when Lincoln is looking for a new running mate in 1864, when he's afraid he may lose, he forms a national union party and runs on a cross-partisan ticket. Lincoln is a Republican and Johnson is a Democrat. And so Johnson is delivered into the presidency by an assassin's bullet. And with the war ending, has to figure out what the future of the country looks like. While the war raged, Johnson and Lincoln were on the same side of the fight. Johnson hated slaveholders even more than Lincoln did. They were the autocratic elite of his state, and they hogged the political power, and he wanted to see their power crushed. With slavery gone, that was the limit of the change that Andrew Johnson wanted to see. He believed, as he said, that this was a white man's country which needed a white man's government. He wanted no civil, much less political rights for the freed slaves or other black people living in the United States, and was prepared to go to extremes to defend that, as were insurgents who were fighting throughout the American South. So this is the backdrop. You have a president whose ascension to that office is of contested legitimacy. Many Republicans felt this wasn't what they had voted for, who many in Congress started to feel were not filling the basic responsibilities of the job. And then the crisis comes, and the crisis is an unprecedented one in American history. There had been five vetoes ever overridden prior to Andrew Johnson taking office. One was at 12:03 a.m. on the last night that Tyler was in office, and the others were river improvement bills under Franklin Pierce. All of a sudden, Congress is passing civil rights legislation and the president is vetoing it and they are overriding it. We'd never asked a president to enforce a law that he had opposed. It hadn't happened before. And Johnson effectively refuses to do it. And so you have unfolding over the course of a couple of years a conflict between a Congress which is telling the president what the law is and asking him to enforce it, and a president who is doing everything that he can to act autocratically and defy that Congress. That's a constitutional crisis.
What did Johnson propose to do with those freed slaves?
He wanted to reestablish the racial hierarchy that had existed in the South before the war. And in fact, the states that, that Johnson wants to come back into the Union, he maintained they'd never really been out of the Union, they start passing these black codes, which say things like a black person can only be off their own land with the written permission of a white person, or they all have to have jobs or they can be locked up for vagrancy, that they need to, you know, step off the sidewalk out of deference to a white person who's walking along. This was the kind of racial hierarchy that Johnson wanted to see established, and it was being established by sword and blood. Throughout the South, you have things like the Ku Klux Klan forming and killing those blacks and also white Republicans who are trying to establish some degree of civil equality. Johnson blames black people for this violence, says that it is their provocative efforts to secure civil and then political rights for themselves that are inciting it, and that Congress is to blame as well for encouraging them in these aspirations toward equality.
So you went into that thinking it was purely political and came away recognizing that there were true important questions raised.
Yes, that's right. You can think of this as a political dispute, right? That there were two different policies that were on the table for the Reconstruction of the United States. But it moves beyond that, because very rapidly it gets to be a question of, is the president upholding his oath to faithfully administer the laws of the United States? Is he defending the Constitution, which Congress is amending to extend rights? Is he fulfilling the ideals? And fundamentally, is he fit for office? He is the first president in office to go and speak to big rallies. This has not been done before. He goes in what's called his swing around the circle. And these are raucous affairs where he gets up there before a crowd of supporters. He adapts his speeches on the fly, listening to what the crowd's applauding and doubling down on that. He'll go back and forth with hecklers. In one of these, notoriously, a heckler suggests that he's to blame for not hanging Jefferson Davis, the Confederate president. And he goes on a riff and suggests that instead, if anyone's going to be hanged, he should be hanging Thad Stevens, who's the leader of the Congressional Republicans. So he's calling for the lynching of his political rivals. This kind of rhetoric greatly disturbed Congress and really called into question the president's fitness for the office that he held.
So where does this go?
Well, you know, there is a process that moves by fits and starts that will, I think, be very familiar to anyone watching the contemporary process unfold. After the swing around the circle, they convene impeachment proceedings. There's a rebuke in a midterm election. It empowers Congress. And the inquiry drags on for more than a year, opening, closing. Whenever it moves further away from impeachment, Johnson acts more autocratically and ignores Congress. Whenever the inquiry is particularly serious, he pulls back a little bit and behaves himself. The early theories of impeachment, many of them were, not to put too fine a point on it, were nuts. The man who had written the 13th Amendment and initially calls for impeachment does so on the theory that Johnson had helped assassinate Abraham Lincoln. He later tells the committee that the evidence he has for this is not the sort of evidence that would be admitted in a court of law. It's more of a hunch, really. And so the process does two things. It starts to focus on the things that Johnson is doing that are genuinely objectionable and well-evidenced, but it also puts a lot of these other theories out there, demands that members of Congress put forward the evidence to substantiate their claims. And where they can't do that, it sets them aside and discards them. So you have this extended process of discernment and discovery, which both holds Johnson back from doing some of the things that he wants to do because he feels the pressure. But much more importantly, it allows the public to start to get a view of what Johnson is like. They get to see what he's actually done. They get to see which claims have evidence and which are unsubstantiated. And that's a really healthy process.
How did it end up?
Well, you know, they don't manage to impeach him at first. And after a year of hearings, they still haven't found the grounds for moving forward. And then Johnson does something extraordinary. He fires his Secretary of War despite previously having recognized a law called the Tenure of Office Act that told him he couldn't do that essentially without Congress's permission. That law may have been unconstitutional, but the firing of the Secretary of War is extraordinary in two ways. One is it is the culminating event. Congress has gone to greater and greater measures to try to get the president to enforce the law. He keeps on firing people who are trying to enforce the law. So the Tenure of Office Act is maybe an unconstitutional extension of Congress's authority, but what it's really about is trying to find some last-ditch effort to just say to the guy, hey, you're the president. Your job is to enforce the law, and you've got to stop firing the people who are trying to actually do that. It doesn't work. He breaks it. The other thing that makes it extraordinary is there is a night in the Capitol, in this city, where it is not clear whether or not we are about to plunge back into civil war. They send telegrams out to Union veterans to summon 100,000 men to Washington. Johnson is rumored to be talking to governors about mobilizing loyal militia to the president. He calls the commander of the Military District of Washington in, and Johnson says, on aesthetic grounds, but you can draw your own conclusions, asks him to swap out the black troops in the Capitol in favor of white troops. And it really does look like we are headed to some sort of violent confrontation. And there are headlines then 24 hours later, which say, in so many words, Congress begins the process of impeachment, war averted. So what Congress does is, by triggering then the process of impeachment, it allows us to take a fight that was about to spill into the streets and channel it back into a rule-bound and orderly forum for a resolution.
And where does that resolution go?
Well, the trial goes on for a while. They hear from witnesses. They review evidence. It gets awfully close. It comes within a single vote of removing Johnson. And historians still argue about why it failed. It's extraordinary that a clear majority of the Senate was prepared to do it. But there are a half dozen Republicans who vote against their party and side with Andrew Johnson. They give one account of their motives. Some of them are concerned about the man who would take over from Johnson. Remember, there's no sitting vice president, so it's the somewhat cantankerous and pro-labor senator who's the president of the Senate at that point. And so not all of the Eastern moneyed interests are particularly interested in elevating him. So there is concern about who would succeed Johnson. There also is suggestive evidence of either direct bribes or certainly promises as a patronage appointments. So many of those who vote with Johnson then spend Johnson's remaining 9 months in office going and cashing in on those votes, getting corrupt appointments and kickbacks from the new office holders. So Johnson buys his way out of it. But the big thing that he does, and I think this is really key, is he also promises to back off. He sends word that he will no longer interfere with congressional reconstruction. And he agrees to appoint a Secretary of War who is amenable to Congress and who extracts from Johnson the promise that he will be allowed to enforce the laws that is written. So the biggest thing that Johnson gets to do is he gets to stay in office, but he has to give up the fight. He was willing to go to the mat in order to make sure that this would remain a white man's country, and he loses that fight. He only survives impeachment by giving in on all of the policy differences with Congress that had provoked it in the first place. And it's that outcome which partially surprised me. I had always learned that this was a story of a few heroic senators standing bravely on principle and voting against their party to support the president in the face of an unconstitutional law. And what I saw instead was a Congress calling a president acting unconstitutionally to account, forcing that president to cede back to Congress the authority to pass laws and to faithfully administer them, and then managing to limp through his last 9 months in office, largely as head of state, but no longer head of government.
So having looked closely into that, is that where you began thinking about the impeachment of Donald Trump?
Yes, I wrote an initial draft of my article and got there in the final page and sat and chatted with colleagues who said to me, you cannot arrive at this at the end. You need to start over and think about this more seriously from the beginning. That's where I got there. I thought, gosh, impeachment doesn't have to remove a president to succeed. It can have a variety of benefits for the civic health of the country. It's not a cataclysm, as is generally regarded. It can be a rare corrective, one to be used with great caution and only in extraordinary circumstances. But if you find yourself with a president who is not discharging his constitutional duties, it is perhaps the only mechanism of restoring some measure of balance. And it can do that whether or not the Senate ultimately votes to remove the president.
So even though Donald Trump is halfway through his presidency, you believe it would be important to begin that process now?
Yes, and I'll give you three reasons for that. One is I do not know if he is halfway through his presidency. He intends to run for a second term and may well be elected to a second term. I don't have a crystal ball, and I think, like many political journalists, I learned a great deal of humility in November 2016 in making these sorts of prognostications. The second is that I think that the harms that his presidency is doing are real and compounding. And so I point here not just to specific policies or acts that I think are dangerous for the system, but also the way the system is responding to Donald Trump. I think Republicans should be extraordinarily concerned, and champions of executive authority should be extraordinarily concerned that we have unelected bureaucrats disregarding and disobeying the president's orders because they don't believe that the orders are wise. They don't believe that he was fit to have given them. We have chiefs of staff walking out of the White House, telling the public to judge them by what they stopped the president from doing rather than by what they helped the president do. That's not healthy. Their authority derives from the elected president. You don't actually want, as a republic, a bunch of unelected bureaucrats deciding, taking it upon themselves to decide which of their elected leadership's instructions are wise and sound and which the president wasn't fit to make. The third is forward-looking. And this is actually the rationale that many Republicans cited when they voted to convene impeachment proceedings and then ultimately, which a small number were in favor of, but then a larger number who made it clear to Nixon that he couldn't stay in office. They grew concerned about what would happen if you didn't correct presidential misconduct. Presidents make precedents. Even if Donald Trump were to lose electorally, even if the American people were to turn against him, as polls suggest they have, that would not set the kind of precedent which tells future chief executives that if they abrogate their responsibilities or try to politicize law enforcement or mix private profit with public office, that they will face removal. What it says is, you know, be 3% better as a politician than the guy who tried all this and lost. And every politician I've met believes that he's at least 3% better than the guy who came before him. This was the rationale ultimately for removing Nixon, which was you couldn't allow misconduct like this to stand without impeachment and removal, because were you to do so, you would be establishing a precedent that other presidents, perhaps presidents even less fit than the current incumbent, would then be able to exploit.
And now a quick break. When we come back, more of my conversation with Yoni Applebaum. He's senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees the ideas section. His latest article is titled Impeach Donald Trump. You can find it now online or in the March issue of The Atlantic magazine. And we're back. Here's the rest of my conversation with historian and journalist Yoni Applebaum. Do you believe that Donald Trump has committed impeachable offenses?
I do, but I'll also say this. I think we know only a small portion of the picture. And so when we think about impeachable offenses, the Constitution tells us it's treason, bribery, or high crimes and misdemeanors. That's all it tells us. And those are tough things to parse. We have a constitutional standard for treason. I've heard the term bandied about with respect to this president. I don't think anything that he has done in office comes close to meeting the very high threshold that we set for treason in the Constitution, and I'm concerned about the use of that word. Bribery as well is a very difficult offense to prove. We've never impeached anyone for bribery. The closest we came was a federal judge whose articles of impeachment for treason and then subsequently another one for bribery used some of the same language. But even a federal judge who joined the Confederacy was not actually impeached for treason. They deliberately avoided the word in the articles of impeachment because the bars for these two crimes are extraordinarily high. But the founders knew that, and they debated it during the convention. And they stood up and said things like, well, if we just put treason and bribery, what do we do about somebody who's simply unfit for office? One suggested maladministration. And Madison shot back that that wasn't actually enough. You could be really bad at the job, but that wouldn't be impeachable. But he didn't dispute the basic premise, which is that you needed a catch-all phrase that would encompass a set of acts, and you can look at the proceedings, and it's clear what they're talking about, is a set of acts where a president betrays his basic duties. We're not talking about crimes necessarily. So they pluck a term of art out of English law, high crimes and misdemeanors, which sounds like something out of a statute, but it's not. And they make this quite clear during the convention when they cite the case of Hastings, which is this English precedent that's unfolding at the time, who's not being charged with criminal offenses. When you say high crimes and misdemeanors, what you mean is something which is broad enough to encompass acts of the greatest gravity. If treason and bribery are acts where a president is pursuing something other than the public interest, he has been subverted in some way. He is loyal to something other than the general interest of the United States. High crimes and misdemeanors are other such acts that are similarly grave in degree and which also involve a president pursuing perhaps a set of private interests or other interests than the public interest that he has sworn to uphold. And so when you look at this president, you have things like the refusal to divest from businesses. You have things like his personal attorney pleading to campaign finance violations, he says, at the president's direction. You have things like his attempt to turn public law enforcement into a tool of private revenge and loyalty. These are, I think, very clearly impeachable acts, which is not to say whether or not Congress should impeach for them, which is a political judgment as well as – but if you're talking just on the technical merits, I don't think there's much dispute that these things are potentially impeachable.
How much depends on the report of Robert Mueller?
It is a great question and probably a little bit different in terms of its politics and its legal merits. Robert Mueller has a relatively narrow ambit for the scope of his investigation. He's been asked to look at potential collusion and Russian electoral interference. That's not going to touch whether the president is violating the Constitution's emoluments clauses. It's not going to touch the campaign finance violations, which came through the Southern District of New York. It's not going to touch potentially his attempt to order the Department of Justice to investigate his political rivals. There are things that he has done that fall outside of the scope of the Mueller probe that we already know about and probably a fair number more that we don't know about. Even within the scope of the Russia investigation, the standing guidance from the Department of Justice is that a special prosecutor cannot indict a sitting president of the United States. It's not clear what form the Mueller report will take. It's not clear whether he has identified potential crimes by the president, if he has, whether or not he would charge them. But he's thinking like a prosecutor because he is a prosecutor. That is his job, is to find out whether or not there is a demonstrable crime which can be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And if so, he can make a referral or ask Congress to act. He's not doing the job that Congress is supposed to be doing. Congress is supposed to be deciding whether or not a president is fit. That shouldn't be the job of a special prosecutor. And when Congress defers to a special prosecutor for as long as it has, it is an abrogation of its own responsibilities.
So do you believe that any members of Congress or a sufficient number of members of Congress will be willing to step forward?
Well, I know two things. One is having heard from members subsequent to the publication of the story, there are members who were already there. There are members who tell me at least that they were persuaded by the arguments here. And I also know that this is not where leadership is within the House, and it's not where even a majority, I think, of the Democratic caucus is, although I have not personally whipped the vote count. I think we're headed here, though, and I think we're headed here for two reasons. One is that this debate is distorting everything that it touches. And so long as Congress refuses to look at it directly, it will continue to have that effect. And so the pressure will mount. The other is that this is a president who has a penchant for provoking crises. He has done so at regular intervals throughout this presidency. He did so in the aftermath of Charlottesville, and he did so again with the family separation policies at the border. At those moments, Democrats in the House, when they were in the minority, stepped forward. Some of them actually introduced articles of impeachment. One of them, Congressman Green, forced a floor vote on such articles, which as a privilege motion, any member can do effectively at any time. I wonder what happens the next time there is a crisis and a member makes a privilege motion to convene impeachment proceedings, and you ask the members of the Democratic caucus to vote as to whether or not they should proceed. I wonder how many members who right now would prefer that the whole thing just went away, when asked to cast that ballot, would be prepared to shut down an investigation.
Nancy Pelosi, the House leader, has said there is not impeachment on the table. Is that a political statement, or is that a really heartfelt statement, do you believe?
Well, I can't look into the speaker's heart. What I can say is that she and others have also made it clear that there are impeachable offenses on the table. And so what we have here is a really interesting rhetorical split. Chairman Nadler of House Judiciary has said that several acts that he's looked at are potentially impeachable.
Such as?
I believe he has said that about the Michael Cohen allegations involving campaign finance. And so when you look at that, you've got somebody saying, well, gosh, we have the potentially impeachable acts, but we're not proceeding at the moment. I have to view that at some level as a political calculation, which is not necessarily improper. Impeachment is a political process, and I certainly understand there is great hesitation about allowing it to appear partisan, about allowing it to appear vindictive. And so there is a hope that perhaps the Mueller report or some other mechanism will suddenly break the logjam and allow Republican members of the House to say in public what some of them are already saying in private, which is that they do not believe this president is fit to serve. But simply standing there and waiting for that moment to come also seems hazardous, in part because it repeats the mistake of the Clinton years.
Norm Ornstein and others have said they fear that should an attempt be made to remove this man from office, that there really could be an armed conflict in the streets.
Well, maybe, only that is what people feared with Johnson, and the opposite turned out to be the case, that there was the same rhetoric around the impeachment of Nixon, and it turned out not to be the case either. Usually impeachment diffuses violence in sort of a counterintuitive way. Violence in the streets is usually a mechanism that people who are frustrated with the system turn to. If they feel that the system cannot correct itself, if they feel that the system is rigged, impeachment if done properly and starts with an inquiry and assembles the evidence and holds public hearings, it focuses public attention elsewhere. It makes it clear that the real stakes of the fight are going to happen in Congress. It disincentivizes the president and his political supporters from riling up the activists on the extremes and similarly with the Democrats, because both sides are trying to appeal to moderates. And so I don't know what would happen if the House moved forward. I don't have a crystal ball. But I do know that in the past, when people have feared this, the opposite has turned out to be the case, that impeachment, by focusing public attention on the only fight that then really matters, diffuses the tensions that might have led to fights that didn't matter as much.
President Trump ordered the government shut down for more than 30 days. He's now given the Congress until mid-February to work out a deal on his wall, or else he's going to shut down the government again. Do you believe that action, both the past and the potential, could lead people to become more resolute in their aim to begin impeachment hearings?
You know, there's this two-track aspect to impeachment. Usually, and this is because the Senate is mostly lawyers, the House is a plurality of lawyers, usually Congress looks for a specific discrete act, you know, something like the alleged campaign finance violations or perhaps something growing like obstruction out of the Mueller probe. But the specific discrete act is never enough. It takes on the color of the underlying offenses, is the language attorneys like to use, or in political terms, it becomes the justification for doing something that Congress has reluctantly concluded needs to be done. When the president shuts down the government, I think it's hard to argue that's an impeachable act. We've had other shutdowns before. But to the extent that Congress looks at this president, he erodes his public support. Members are no longer as concerned about crossing their own constituents. Their own constituents are losing patience with the president. So both in terms of the erosion of public support and also in terms of feeding a sense that the government is not working as it should, I think there's great political peril for the president in continuing to pursue his current course in these negotiations, precisely because he has left himself exposed in so many other ways to the process of impeachment. And it's one reason why triggering the process might have salutary effects. I know that some members, Adam Schiff, responded to my article by saying that he was concerned that it was too glib about the prospect of shutting down the government, of tying up a president. And I hear that. That's not something that should be done lightly. But the converse is also true. This is a president who is literally shutting down the government. And so if you have a president who is acting in extra-constitutional ways, impeachment tends to focus the mind. It tends to diminish the number of provocations. It tends to lead the president to discover hitherto unimagined reservoirs of restraint. Even a president like Andrew Johnson or like Donald Trump, neither of whom is known for the careful exercise of self-restraint. Certainly Johnson managed to find a way to keep his mouth shut as the proceedings moved forward because he learned reluctantly, but he learned that he'd become his own worst enemy and that every time he took an act or gave a speech, he was simply feeding his critics with additional ammunition. That restraining force is something that the prospect of further shutdowns is likely to make seem more appealing.
In your estimation, how likely do you see impeachment beginning?
I think that it's hard to imagine this president getting through the next 2 years without provoking the kind of crisis that would lead the House majority to convene the proceedings. Once they've done that, they will need to do what they have not done so far, which is introduce into the public record clear evidence to substantiate specific charges against the president. My judgment is that evidence is there. I don't entirely know because, like everybody else, I'm reading a lot of the stuff through secondhand media reports, through confidential leaks. There may be exculpatory material that's not in the public record. Witnesses may have things to say that we have not heard them say. It's precisely that uncertainty which makes the process healthy. So I have trouble imagining we'll get through the next 2 years without triggering the process. I don't know where it leads then. If the evidence is so certain and absolute that it becomes difficult for Republicans to look at it and to dismiss, then it could conceivably even lead to the president's removal. If, on the other hand, it turns out that this is mostly smoke and not fire, then I think for the Republic it would also be healthy to know that. It would be healthy for us to put this out into the open and to have an open debate about what is known and what is not known, rather than to continue along our present trajectory.
There's another possibility many have talked about, and that is that the president himself would simply resign. What do you think the possibilities are?
Well, not many people thought Richard Nixon would resign, but in the end, when he was cornered and had no other options, he chose that over removal. It's hard for me to see a president who is known for his imperviousness to the kinds of arguments that have constrained other presidents making that kind of calculation, unless under extreme duress. And so I could imagine a resignation at a moment when removal seemed like the only other option, or perhaps, as we've seen in some state-level proceedings with the impeachment of governors, where it is worked out in a deal with prosecutors. But it's hard for me to imagine this president simply giving up and going.
Yoni, fascinating, fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all for today. I'd love to hear what's on your mind. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. You can find all our podcasts and even old Diane Rehm shows at dianerehm.org. Our theme music is by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Natalie Urev-Livker and Josephine Neonai. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with you on Tuesday. I'm Diane Rehm.